Then let's get started. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to this work session. Commissioner Fitz is going to be here momentarily. We have a pretty high content process here for the next couple of hours, so I won't spend a lot of time in introductory remarks other than that to state the obvious, we are in a housing emergency. And the Home for Everyone model that we have created, I believe, is the right model to address both homelessness and housing. And Mark Jolin is doing a great job of orchestrating that, and he's going to lead this work session. So with that, Mr. Jolin.
Good morning, Mayor. Commissioners, thank you for giving us this opportunity. I say us because there are a number of people who are going to join us over the course of the morning to share the work that they've been doing on this project. We do have, if you're looking at the PowerPoint, it's long, but we're going to move quickly through it. Just to set the context a little bit for you, this is a project that started more than a year ago. It's a combined effort of the City of Portland, Multnomah County, City of Gresham, Home Forward, and our philanthropic faith and business partners. And the purpose of the work broadly is to have one table, one place where we all gather to try to address the issue of homelessness in our community, to try to speak with one voice, to be very clear with the community what work it is that we're doing, what the challenges are that we face, and how we propose to tackle them. The beginning of this, and I don't know if Chair Kafoury has arrived yet, and so Chair Kafoury and Michael Bonacore, the director of Home Forward, are both going to join us here. And Michael's here. Michael. Do you want to come on up, Michael? All right. So I asked Chair Kafoury and Michael Bonacore just to come and talk about their experience of and the importance to them of this initiative and the collaboration that we have underway here. So.
Mayor, commissioners, it's nice to be here. Thanks. So I'm here just to say a few brief words this morning about our ongoing commitment to the collaboration. We have been really heartened in the time that Home for Everyone has been in existence by the depth of collaboration and coordination, our sense of connection to the jurisdictions, and of doing our work in ways that feel connected to a larger system, and also appreciate the efforts that have been made, good morning, to inform that work by listening to the voices of the community. So my message this morning is simple. We are at the table and deeply committed. We continue to find ways to make resource allocation commitments and prioritizations that match the priorities of a home for everyone. We will, in the next couple of months, issue a new strategic plan in which our commitment to the partnership is explicitly called out. And we intend to continue to stay sleeves rolled up and deeply connected to this work.
Yes. Good morning, Madam Chair. Welcome. Just push the button. Because those of us who work in this building week have been actually not using the system right, so they've been giving us remedial help.
Hello, is that right? Okay. I don't read instructions. That's not what I'm. Thank you, Deborah Kafoury, Multnomah County Chair. I'm sorry that we are in this close proximity because, as you can probably hear from my voice, I am a little under the weather. So I should have brought masks for everyone. Yes, scoot over. No, you deserve to be really close. thank you for having us here this morning to talk a little bit about a home for everyone. As you know, ensuring that everyone in our community has a safe, decent, affordable place to sleep is one of our top priorities. We've learned through our work at Multnomah County that all of the other work that we do, be it alcohol and drug treatment, mental health treatment, nothing really seems to stick if people don't have a place to live. And that's why we formed Home for Everyone a little more than a year and a half ago, a partnership between the county, the city, I almost called you. Sorry, Home Forward. There you go. Still got the new name in my head. And the cities of Gresham and some of our other partners in the community. The way that we used to do things with the city working on homeless individuals and the county working with homeless families, we know that those artificial barriers just don't work. And having us work together as a team is so much more effective. We will eliminate barriers, we'll make things more efficient and effective. And although it's not very exciting to talk about, I like to say that, you know, a mom whose kid is sleeping in a car doesn't really care which jurisdiction is providing the services. She just wants someone to help her. So last June, the county invested $2.5 million in new resources for housing placement and year-round shelter. And for the first time ever, we set aside $5 million for funding new affordable housing construction. The city matched our investment, and those dollars are now being put to work. A new shelter for veterans opened its doors on Veterans Day. Earlier this month, a former strip club was turned into a year-round family shelter and expanded its capacity to 150 people. And crucially, our family shelter operates on a no-turn-away policy, so any family in our community that needs shelter can get it. These are the kinds of critical investments that we can make together, and I'm committed to working with you. Earlier this year, the county prioritized a $10 million in our next budget, and the city thankfully has agreed for $20 million, and that $30 million investment, I believe, when put on the streets, will really make a difference for people in our community. Thank you.
Good to have you here.
Mr. Salzman, do you have any?
So we really appreciate both of you as partners. I think this model is working well, and I think it's goodwill and good government combined. So thank you for being good partners.
And they forgot to put turn off mic when done speaking, so they're going to have to redo all of these instructions. Sorry.
So, Mark, I have a question. You have a long PowerPoint. At the end, when we have some questions about next steps, will we have representatives of Home Forward in the county here at the end of the presentation?
Not these representatives. So if you have questions for them, yeah. I would encourage you to ask them now.
Well, I just have a comment. Home Forward traditionally in our community houses the poorest of the poor. If you have no resources in public housing, you house them. If you are at 0 to 30 and you're the most impacted person in our community, you are a houser of first resort. The county provides services to people that are in need. We know that there's a whole segment of the people on the street that without services, their housing is not going to be successful. That's why we have a permanent supportive housing model of housing plus services. One of the things that I think is becoming clearer to us is that we've identified a crisis on the street, but there's a mismatch with the housing we're investing in. And when we hear that less than 15% of the dollars are going into housing that actually addresses the crisis on the street, that's a mismatch. That's not to say that people at 60% MFI or 80% MFI, workforce housing, people in that sweet spot don't deserve quality housing. We obviously do. It simply says that if you have $1 and you're in a crisis, do you house, do you put it into housing that's nice to have, or do you put it into the housing that the emergency is calling for? And I guess the question I'm going to have at the end of this, and the question I hope the council takes up each and every time funding comes before us, are we investing in the right housing? And if we're not, then it seems like we're going to have a problem, because whatever we're doing that you and the mayor are leading on an emergency basis is premised on the fact that we will get people off the streets into homes. Not shelters, but homes. And if we are not building enough homes that people on the streets can afford, then that's a mismatch. And so I want to put that out there, because I think in addition to all the great work you're doing, we're going to have to insist that the RFPs and the other things that we do target where the need is. And I would welcome your comment.
Thank you for that, Commissioner Fish. I am in complete agreement. I think two things. One is that the dollars that we allocated this year, the $2.5 million, a lot of that has gone to rapid rehousing, getting people off the streets and into permanent housing, as you talked about, not necessarily shelter. And in the past, we used to allocate $5,000 per family, and that was how much it took to get them into housing and then stable, and then we could move on. Now it's somewhere anywhere between, averaging about $8,500. So that's a big increase, which means that fewer people are able to get off the streets and into housing. And that's because the housing at the lower end of the scale is just not there. And as you talked about, I think it's crucial that we are targeting the dollars that we're spending on the construction side to the dollars that were and the numbers that we're looking for on the people side, because otherwise the two are not going to match. And if we're not building housing that is for the 0 to 30% MFI, we're not going to meet the goals that we've outlined in our in the presentation you're going to hear today.
Well, I appreciate you saying that, because no one here disagrees with the premise that we should provide housing for everyone. And when my daughter comes back from her great adventure and is priced out of the market, this will hit home. And we want workforce, we want entry-level workers, we want everybody to be able to afford a home. The problem is we have an emergency, and if there isn't a clear path for people on the streets to get into a stable home and begin to become sufficient, then that's a mismatch. And I just think that with all the bold actions being taken on the one side of the ledger and declaring an emergency, we're going to have to be rigorous in making sure the dollars are being spent to address that need. And I appreciate your comments.
Feel better.
Thank you very much. So in terms of the work session structure today, this was obviously an important way to kick it off, because I think the collaborative nature of this work really is what makes it stand out. We're going to do just a little bit of a reminder about who's homeless and what some of the characteristics are of people who are experiencing homelessness in our community very briefly, then share with you the model that we've been working from that helps us understand what the unmet need is and what it's going to take to meet it, both in terms of permanent housing and safety off the streets options. And then we're going to build towards sharing with you the recommendations for the $20 million in committed additional services that went to the executive committee about a month and a half ago, by asking representatives from the work groups that did the community-based prioritization work around strategies related to housing, healthcare, employment, and safety off the streets to come forward and share what their work groups did, how they prioritized, and then have someone from our coordinating board also come and share with you her experience of the coordinating board prioritization process that led to those executive committee recommendations. So hopefully, by the time we're done here, you'll have a good understanding of the strategies that are at the core of the recommendations that are coming both to the city and to the county for how to invest the $20 million that the chair referenced. So that's kind of the plan. I've asked each of the speakers to make sure that their presentation is short enough that there's some time to ask questions of them. So hopefully that will happen. I think we'll try to stay ahead of schedule enough that we can ask questions at the end. We will also, after the coordinating board and Home for Everyone folks have finished speaking, Joe Zender will be here to talk about some shelter siting regulatory reform possibilities. And then the director of the Housing Bureau, Kurt Krieger, will be here to talk about the development side of the conversation a little bit more in depth. All right. So starting with a reminder for all of you, and hopefully for the community, of how many people are homeless. Broadly, what we see in Oregon in the last count, about 13,226 people were homeless, and in Portland, 3,801. Just as a comparison, Washington had 19,419 people homeless, and Seattle had more than double the number of literally homeless people in their last street count. As you've heard, and we had the gathering of West Coast mayors here, the challenge of homelessness and housing affordability is not Portland's alone by any means. It's one that cities up and down the West Coast are facing at least as severely, and in some cases more severely even than we are. The the best data that we have in our community to understand how many people are experiencing homelessness is our point-in-time count. It's something that we do every 2 years, but we'll start doing annually next year. The most recent survey was in January of 2015, and in that count, we identified 1,887 individuals who were sleeping outside or in a vehicle in a park someplace not meant for human habitation. Those are unsheltered people. Then if you include the number of people who are also in shelter and transitional housing, our number is 3,801. That is really the definition of homelessness that HUD uses. And so commonly when someone says, how many people are homeless in your community, we say 3,801. But we also know that many, many people are doubled up and don't have permanent housing of their own, and they're surviving on somebody's couch or a basement. And the best estimate we have of that number, and this is on any given night in Multnomah County, 16,344 people. So that's inclusive of the HUD homeless number plus those who we estimate are also doubled up in our community. In terms of who is homeless, the street count also provides us good data, the best data we have on the demographics of the community. It is, as you can see here, I won't read all of the statistics, but we have over 1,161 women who are homeless. African Americans are dramatically overrepresented, as are communities of color in general in the homeless population. Veterans, as you've heard by now, in January of 2015, made up just 12% of the homeless population, about 422 individuals. Many of those veterans are now fortunately housed. Among women, 45% report having experienced domestic violence. We had 374 children under the age of 18 who were homeless on that night in January of 2015. There's a very high rate of disability in the community. 57% of the people we surveyed self-report being disabled. 36% of those self-report having a mental health disability. Almost half have an addiction disability. It's important.
But just to be clear, when you say almost half, do you mean almost half of the disabled or almost half of the total population?
No, almost half of those who identify as disabled identify as their disability as being an addiction. It's important to see that while it often feels like we have the same people living on our streets year after year, 33% of the people we surveyed had only been homeless less than 6 months. Only 27% of the homeless people we surveyed had been outside for more than 2 years. So we definitely do have a long-term homeless population, but many people in our community are becoming homeless, getting assistance, and going back into housing every year. So it is a population that turns over, and it's an experience that many more people have than just the 4,000 people who we count on a given night outside.
Mark, do we track where people are from?
We do ask where people are from. In the 2015 count, we had 80% of the people said that they had been in Multnomah County for more than 2 years. Only 224 people reported that they came to Multnomah County homeless. And of those, only about, and I'm anticipating the rest of this question because it comes up a lot, only about 15% reported that services were the reason that they came here. So we do have people, a small percentage, who are coming to Multnomah County homeless, mostly for the same reasons that anybody comes to Multnomah County, which is family, friends, a job opportunity, looking for a fresh start.
That 80% figure is very important because what we often hear, in fact, we've heard it since Bud Clark put homelessness as the center of the city's agenda, that by investing in a cure, we were putting out the welcome mat, which is an argument you hear at the federal level around every single program we invest in, and it's simply not true. And as you note, the small number of people that choose to come to Portland because it's Portland are no different than middle-class people come here for a job or anyone else. It's Portland is a draw. But the overwhelming majority of the people we're serving are local people. And I think it's important people know that.
Yeah, I keep quoting the little statement that Carl Abbott did in the 1987 10-year plan where he said that Seattle believes that Portland is sending them our homeless. Portland believes that Seattle is sending us their homeless, and Boise thinks that we're both sending them our homeless. So, you know, it's just, it's a myth that will not go away.
True.
Any other questions before I move on about the population we have in our community that's experiencing homelessness.
Well, I guess I have one question, Mark. So in 10 years, 12,000 people go from the streets to homes. And yet, some in our community have declared that's a failure. How do you explain that distinction between the success that the community has had getting people off the streets and into shelter and homes, and the fact that homelessness continues to be persistent and stubborn?
That's a perfect lead-in to the next couple of slides. So why are people homeless? And I tried. Okay, it's going to build. So, in essence, it is the mismatch between income and housing affordability, right? The reason that we can, and last year, our community helped 3,500 people in 1 year move out of homelessness and back into permanent housing and help thousands more retain their housing who we'd housed in previous years. And still new people became homeless because in our community, many, many people are living on very little or no income. And as we've noted, we have a crisis of affordability, especially at the low end of the market. Our most recent estimates are that we're short 24,000 units of rental housing that's affordable to people who are in the 0 to 30% of area median income bracket. In that situation, a certain number of people are going to become homeless every year. And what we've seen over the past decade is that on average, folks, we were making some progress before the recession, but as the recession hit and housing prices continued to climb, but incomes fell, new people became homeless. What progress we had made, we were definitely set back. So that right now, what we've been able to do, notwithstanding the recession, is house about as many people every year as are becoming homeless, which is why in the last point in time count, we saw only about a 4% increase in the total HUD homeless population. So I'm pulling up here recession, unemployment, health problems. These are all related factors for why someone who is low income and paying too much for rent might become homeless. There are many people in those circumstances who don't. But at the end of the day, all right, I'm going to get there. Sorry. At the end of the day, it's really this chart that does as good a job as any of summarizing it, which just shows you, in essence, that even as rents have continued to grow fairly significantly, incomes have fallen, especially for our lowest income earners. With rents going up over 30% in the past 5 years, wages have fallen 5% at the same time. That is the recipe for homelessness in our community.
So Mark, I think this is an important point to dwell on. I mean, would you be able to estimate if rents and incomes had risen at the same level, or if, say, we could just say rents, let's put rents back at 2000 levels, what impact would that have on the homeless population? Would that cut it in half? Would it cut it in a third?
I definitely cannot answer that question with that specificity off the top of my head. It might be something we could go back and try to reconstruct, but I don't think there's any question, given that a lot of what is driving this issue is inflow. Again, it's not a stagnant population of 4,000 people who are just out on our streets year after year. We're housing a lot of people. If we're not seeing a change in the point-in-time number, it means that just as many people or more are becoming homeless, and that really is, for many folks, just a function of not being able to afford their housing. I know we're hearing from our family shelter provider, Human Solutions, that somewhere in the neighborhood of 25% of the families they're seeing come into the shelter right now are reporting that they've never been homeless before. That's an indicator that the stress of low incomes, high rents, is causing families to fall out in our community.
So do you have a number for the number of people who did not actually become homeless because we were able to give them rent assistance to do first and last to get them rapid rehousing? I think that's important too, because you shouldn't have to be out on the streets in order to be able to get the assistance. As we all know, it's cheaper to keep people in housing than to rehouse them?
I don't have the prevention number for last year, but I will get it for you.
Mm-hmm. Mark, this chart you've shown us with a gap between rent, immediate changes in rent and income, I mean, that tells part of the story, but to what extent is it this gap, and to what extent is it that we have historically low vacancy rates and there just isn't a sufficient supply?
I think they're related. I think rents are increasing in part because there's so much demand for the limited housing stock we have. So we're both, the low vacancy rate creates challenges for people at a variety of levels, including that they may be more likely to be screened out. So folks who have barriers are going to have a harder time getting in when there are more people competing for the limited number of units that are out there. And at the same time, with low vacancy rates, rents rise because landlords can ask more for the units. So moving on to our plan, and when I say our plan, it is our community plan. It's a home for everyone, the United Community Plan to End Homelessness. I'm going to talk just a little bit about the framework for that plan so that you and those in the community can see what's driving the work that we're doing. And it really starts with a clear vision, shared values, and focus. The vision is straightforward, that no one should be homeless. Everyone needs a safe and stable place to call home. We have guiding values that we have all agreed to, that we must prioritize those who are most vulnerable, that we must promote racial and ethnic justice. We have to hold the programs we fund accountable and use data to make decisions. We need to engage and involve the community at every level, and we need to strengthen system capacity and increase our leveraging opportunities. And then we've got key focus areas in this work, and they are what anyone who does this work understands are the sort of essential elements of addressing homelessness. First among them, housing. Second, income and benefits, as we've been discussing. Third, health. Fourth, survival and emergency services. Fifth, access to services. And sixth, system coordination. All of the work that we're doing, all of the implementation and action planning work we do on this as part of this initiative is guided by this vision, these values, and these focus areas. Essential to this plan is that we're using proven strategies. We are asked often about whether we're using best practices, and Portland has been both using the best practices demonstrated in other communities and developing best practices locally for the better part of a decade. One of the strategies we've been using for a very long time in this community is now nationally recognized best practice of rapid rehousing. The vast majority of the people who leave homelessness with the assistance of our community partners are using rapid rehousing. It means a limited amount of rent assistance and some staff support to assist them, someone in finding a unit and getting set up in a unit.
Mark, and when you talk about using best practices, could you address the question, can't we just do what Utah does because they've ended homelessness?
I can briefly. So they haven't ended homelessness. To be clear, what they did is very similar to what we've done with veterans homelessness, which is they prioritized chronically homeless people in their community, and they were able to take the number of chronically homeless people that they were seeing in their point in time count on any given night, which was about 2,000 originally, down to a couple hundred a night. So they built some capacity to house chronically homeless people by building a fair amount of permanent supportive housing and using a housing first strategy, which is also a strategy that we use. They started with a smaller number. They have a lot of opportunities around the housing development side that we don't have in terms of cost and state level engagement. So what they've accomplished is impressive and important to learn from. But the strategies that they're using are the ones that we also use in our community to try to meet the needs of chronically homeless people. And others may have more to add when they come up about that. So another important piece of the work is benefits access. This is helping people acquire income who are severely disabled and need benefits, long-term disability benefits, to pay the rent. Employment assistance, you'll hear more about these as we go forward. Eviction prevention, Commissioner Fritz, as you were saying, this is a critical element. We prefer to have people not lose their housing in the first place than have them become homeless and have to be rehoused. And then permanent supportive housing, which is the model of housing that Utah used and that we use as well to meet the needs of chronically homeless people, coupled with long-term rent assistance typically.
Mark, in terms of benefits, I had assumed that the passage of the Affordable Care Act and the Medicaid expansion would have a big impact on mental health and addiction treatment services, mm-hmm. and that a lot of single people, you know, who previously weren't eligible for those services would be under the ACA. Has that happened, and has that had any impact on your ability to help people with addiction and mental health issues?
So that I think that has happened, and Amanda Saul is here from the healthcare work group, and she'll be up in just a few minutes, and maybe ask her that question. She can answer it better than I can. So we're using best practices, and very importantly, this plan depends on accountable community governance. And so what you'll see here is just an organizational chart. The executive committee, by now, I think you're familiar with, that the mayor and Commissioner Saltzman sit on, and the chair and Commissioner Bailey, Michael Bonacore is there, Gresham is represented. That group meets, has been meeting quarterly, will meet every other month to oversee the implementation of the work of the initiative. Supporting the executive committee is a coordinating board of appointed membership. It is really all of the stakeholder communities, very importantly, people with lived experience of homelessness, people in the nonprofit sector that are providing services, culturally specific providers. It's the business community, the faith community, representatives from education. So really, folks who engage this work at a variety of levels and bring the expertise to the table that make sure that the strategies we're pursuing are the right ones. And then they're supported by a series of standing work groups and committees, including what we call the Community Advisory Forum, which is a place where providers and service recipients come together monthly to talk about the experiences they're having. And we have standing work groups that you're about to hear from, too, again, in the areas of housing, health, employment, and safety off the street, and the veterans group as well. All right, and now I'm going to ask Sally Erickson. Had hoped to be able to be here. She couldn't today. She is the head of homeless programs at the Portland Housing Bureau. But Ryan Dibert, who works with her on her team, has agreed to come and do the next part of the presentation.
And I came to this end of the table to help co-pilot the PowerPoint a little bit earlier, so I'll stay here. I think it'll let me point out some of the pieces of the slides to folks who can actually see the electronic version, but I'll narrate them for you as well. So, you know, as Mark said, one of the important things that we've done with A Home for Everyone is create that shared and accountable governance structure. Probably the most important thing from my vantage point that allowed is some real shared leadership, particularly through our executive committee, in challenging our community to do as much as we could. And I think in particular, one of the most innovative things that the executive committee asked at the very beginning of this work was they reached to our coordinating board and said, we want you to stop asking the question, how do we do the most we can with the limited resources we have? And instead, we want you to tell us, what would it take? That work of figuring out what it would take to actually end homelessness in our community and asking the question in that way was frankly a watershed in terms of how we approached assessing the scale of the problem and the potential solutions. So in doing that work, we had some careful modeling to answer that question, what would it take? And I want to step you briefly through what that looked like to set context for some of the plans, both that we've been implementing over this fiscal year and going into next fiscal year. So in terms of modeling what it would take, we have very good data about how many people are homeless in our community at a single point in time. From there, though, as Mark said, we know this isn't a static population of people. Many people move out of homelessness, so there's outflow. People are either move into permanent housing or they self-resolve. We'll sometimes say they're able to move out of homelessness on their own or through assistance that our providers help to provide. We also know, though, that many people come into homelessness. There's continued inflow into homelessness, either people becoming newly homeless or people who have been previously housed returning to homelessness. When we look at that picture over the course of a year, we can see that there's an annualized population of people who have experienced homelessness at some point during the year, and that there's a significant portion of those people who have a met need. They've been able to move into permanent housing from homelessness. There's also a significant portion that remain with unmet need at the end of the year. When the coordinating when the executive committee asked our board, tell us what it would take, specifically they asked, tell us what it would take to reduce that unmet need by half in the course of 2 years. So that's the modeling that we began to work using our current data. We started by asking, this next slide, the pre-HFE status quo slide. We started by asking if we just did nothing different than what we were currently doing, would that be enough? And to orient you to the slide, that dashed line there represents the 3,000 people per year that we were able to house in the 14-15 fiscal year, the level of effort that we were able to demonstrate. The red dashed line is that goal of decreasing unmet need by half. And we modeled, if we just kept doing what we were doing, housing 3,000 people per year, would it get us to that goal? And the answer there is obviously no. This is an important question, and it relates to your earlier question, Commissioner Fish, in terms of that we have a great success story to tell, that every year we have been moving more than 3,000 people off of the streets and into housing, and yet you can walk outside the door today and see that there is still a persistent problem. This is a good picture and a very helpful way to understand why.
And I know it's not a perfect analogy, but I keep going back to a scene in my childhood favorite movie called Fantasia. And it's a scene in the basement of a house with a brigade of mops. And they're furiously mopping out the basement, but there's a flood of water coming down the stairs. And I liken it a little bit to how this community has responded to homelessness through the recession and now during a recovery, which has had some unintended consequences, which is people are valiantly in the basement trying to keep the flood from happening. But no one can prevent the flood. And the flood that is occurring is all the causes beyond our control. We don't send people to war. We didn't defund the mental health system nationally. We didn't, in and of ourselves, create income inequality. We're not failing to enforce inclusionary zoning. I mean, we can go on and on and on. And the water that's coming down in that scene in Fantasia, we don't control. We've never said we did control it. But we're doing a hell of a job keeping the basement as dry as possible, which means getting people to a better place. And I think if we keep that in mind, we realize that ultimately there's a problem beyond our control, but the focus needs to be on supply. We have a shortage of units, and that is fundamentally the problem.
Thank you. So, we started by asking that question: if we just kept doing, would that be enough? Doing what we're doing, and the answer was no. The next question we asked very quickly onto the next slide was: if we did what we were doing, but just did it better. So if we improved retention from an already very high rate of 80% retaining their housing a year after their services ended, if we improved that to 85%, would that in and of itself be enough? And the answer, again, was no. So the next slide pointed us the way home, if you will, to look at additional placement. We needed to be able to move more people off of the streets and into housing than we had before. So what you see on this slide is a green line here that's showing our increased placement effort that would be required to move this orange line down, which is our unmet need line, to that goal of reducing unmet need by half. So we actually, part of what we were able to do in examining that was both look at the short-term goal and what it would take, but we were also able to, on this next slide that's titled long-term additional placement only, we were able to start to map that out over the course of the next 10 years and ask the question, if we knew that we needed some increased effort for now to begin making headway, how much sustained effort would we need over time in order to keep up with that inflow and begin to actually reduce unmet need even more significantly? In this view, looking at additional placement effort only, what you see is that you would have to ramp up a system to one that could serve well, more than 4,000 people a year with permanent housing, and that we would have to sustain that indefinitely. And that really led us to a much clearer picture of ultimately what it would take, which is this next slide, which importantly adds this blue line to the mix, which is an increasing focus on homelessness prevention. So
just a question before you move on. Why did you pick reducing homelessness by half instead of completely eliminating it?
It was at the direction of the executive committee to look at what would be, I think, a very significant goal in a very short period of time.
And would it be fair to say that doubling the investments would end it, or is the second half much more difficult and expensive?
We can talk about that as we look to some of the out years. I think that the second half will require, again, an increased level of effort that wouldn't exactly translate to perfect doubling. So just very quickly, again, you know, this overall picture, the green line, points us to a fairly specific level of increased effort that we would need to make to drive down unmet need by half. It points us to that very next slide that actually it allowed us to start to model out specifically how much more placement would we have to do, how much additional prevention effort would we do, and roughly what would that cost. So in looking at this fiscal year that we're currently in, we said we looked and said we would need approximately $10 million more to house 750 people more than we had the year before. Between City Council and the Board of County Commissioners, that investment came through. We're delivering on that right now. And then in looking ahead to the coming fiscal year, that gap between our prior effort and the amount of effort that we would need in next fiscal year totaled about $30 million in increased investment and increased placement for about 1,350 additional people. As Mark covers a little bit later, some of those investment strategies, you'll see that they're very much geared toward meeting these goals.
Are you going to go into whether it's $30 million in ongoing or one time?
I don't think so in that, quite in that frame. I mean, I think what this graph tells us is that however we fund it, we need to sustain it for a period of time, not indefinitely, but we'll need to make sure that we're able to continue that additional capacity in our system for a number of years.
So it's fair to think of the $30 million being ongoing for the next 5 years?
So with the caveat that of the 30, $10 million is a capital investment, $20 million is the services, and that's really what's buying that, predominantly that increase in placement capacity. We obviously need the unit investments to continue at that level and higher. So yes, I mean, we're gonna need to sustain that investment level, that $20 million of additional for several years.
And you don't foresee increases in the out years, at least under this plan?
So the way that the model works, no. I think we have to be aware that we have a significant number of chronically homeless people on our streets who are going to need higher level per person investments in order to successfully get off the streets. So to the extent that in the out years we've done less for them now than we needed to because we didn't have the housing stock available or the depth of support services, it could be more expensive to serve those people. It is possible, and we're certainly keeping our fingers crossed, that the federal government will come forward with more resources for the chronically homeless community. It's been in the president's budget the last 2 years. It is HUD's priority to address chronic homelessness, but absent that, we'd have to find the local resources to do it.
Mark, you've lost me on the, you guys have lost me on this slide. So, what is your baseline assumption here as to how much the city's going to invest annually from all sources to actually build housing? So this is some services and some placement, but are you assuming $60 to $100 million a year of investment in bricks and sticks over a period of time? Because without the inventory, many of our tools aren't working very well. Vouchers aren't working. Short-term rent assistance doesn't work very well if there's not available units. So the $30 million, particularly with a big chunk of that being services and short-term rent assistance, stuff, I get that. But what's your assumption in terms of ongoing investment in bricks and sticks?
So the assumption around the $10 million and sort of what the work plans asked for was another 250 units a year specifically available to homeless people or people at risk of homelessness, so to very low-income people. The $10 million is payment towards that by one means or another. And I, you know, there's also a policy request in the work plan that we increase the overall commitment locally to 0 to 30 housing that came out of the work group as, and is separate from the specific financial ask around services.
So Dan and Charlie and colleagues, you know, this is a lot of data, and it's sometimes hard to track it. And then, you know, we have these council presentations on tax abatements, on projects, on everything. What I think we should consider is an impact statement with every project that comes to council that shows how the investment applies to whatever the goals are for the year and the different categories of housing that we need to invest in order to meet the plan. So whatever the Home for Everyone says we need to do at every level, I think what's missing is our ability to just check against that. Okay, we're spending this much money. It's a big chunk of our discretionary dollar. How is it going to address the categories that we've said we need to invest in to cut homelessness in half and make a dent? And that way it gives us each and every time we vote on this a reality check to see are we targeting the money to the right need, and how are we doing? So I think this idea of a housing impact statement makes sense. I want to talk to you both about it. It's done in other cities, and it is not very burdensome. But if we're saying that we've got to build 250 units a year for people that are 0 to 30, and we've got to increase our discretionary spending for services and placement, well, that's a plan. I applaud that plan. Now let's figure out how we meet it every time we do a budget decision or we do a funding decision.
So actually picking up, Commissioner, on your reference to $60 million a year, I mean, if we're spending something like $200,000 per unit and we need 250 units a year, doesn't that mean that we have to spend about $50 million a year on new capacity?
See, we're not spending anywhere near 200,000 a unit, and unfortunately, some of our critics have salted the narrative with that to discredit our work. And let me give an example. Last week, Dan brought the St. Francis forward. And I think you noted, or Amanda noted, that our investment was fairly modest given the overall benefit of the project. That's because our dollars leverage other dollars. So we don't put anywhere near $200,000. And in fact, in Dan's most recent RFP, he put as a requirement that people show how they can bring costs down on the overall unit. But we can't allow those arguments to go unanswered because we don't put $200,000 of public money in. It may end up costing $200,000 because it's a special needs housing with all the bells and whistles and has common areas and healthcare clinic on site. Our piece is usually a fraction of that. And then tax credits and other sources fill the gap. But the public investment is not even close to that.
So do we have like an average of, for a new unit, here's how much public investment is necessary?
The problem with an average, I'm just going to caution you, there's a lot of data, is that, and I want to just put it on the table, the kind of housing that we're lacking right now, housing plus services with spaces in the building to provide services, is by definition more expensive. So to get at the need, we're going to have to spend more in dollars and services, which is going to raise a question about not stretching the dollar as far as we could to meet other needs. But this is where the media does not do us a favor in just taking buildings, dividing by the units, and saying, look at that. They don't distinguish between who puts what money in. They aggregate things so that a building that's service enriched, it has all kinds of services built in, gets attributed to each unit to make it look like these units are exotic. And that's why averages don't work.
So PHB's director, Kurt Krieger, will be here at the end and probably can answer that question as well.
So the very last slide I'd like to cover for this section is just It helps to address some of the question that you offered, Commissioner Fritz, these questions about ongoing versus one-time investments. This takes those annualized numbers that we were looking at in prior graphs and switches it to look at on any given night in Portland. So it switches it back to that point in time view again. And just to orient you to the graph very quickly, the blue line is if we had stayed at the level of effort that we had previously had in terms of housing people, how many people would remain homeless on a given night. Again, it's that same picture of we're doing a great job of housing thousands of people, but on any given night, you don't see a very significant shift in the total numbers of people who are out. Versus if you make the types of investments and increased housing placements that are recommended through these plans, the green line begins to become the picture of how many people are homeless on any given night. The dashed line here is our current inventory of emergency shelter and transitional housing beds. So anytime the green line is above that dashed line, you have street homelessness. You have people who are living on the streets. There aren't enough available shelter or transitional housing beds on a given night. So the dashed line that's here is reflective of the increased shelter beds that we've been able to produce this year through the state of emergency, as well as the planned increases through next year, through the plans that you're going to be seeing. I think importantly, it's also worth orienting toward this area that's in blue, which is really, that's that level of need that's intended to be addressed through the plans that you saw in last week's work session, a lot of the planning work that's happening out of the mayor's office in addressing the number of people who are homeless on a given night until we both begin to get more people off the streets and have additional shelter capacity that can address that need.
I just want to pause before you move on, because this is the number, $30 million to get to decreasing the level of homelessness rapidly. And I was not aware till this moment that, I mean, I've heard about $30 million before, but I thought maybe there was another ask coming for $60 million later and then $100 million or whatever it might be. But let me just make sure I'm understanding. You're saying that if we invested, or if somebody invested $30 million ongoing, that that would do it to get to half.
That's correct. And Mark is going to cover specifically some of the actual programmatic investments that we would need to make that happen.
Right. And how much of the $30 million is allocated to us versus the county? Has that been discussed?
So the commitment was that the county would contribute $10 million and that the city would contribute $20 million.
In this year's, the 6.2 that we've already, that has already been allocated in the bump and other actions, that counts towards our $20 million?
Some of it, perhaps. I think it's what we need to see is a $20 million increase over what the base service level was coming into this year. So if some of that is sustained investment going forward, in other words, if it's some an ongoing commitment, then it would count. The question is whether that resource is actually going to be spent in the next fiscal year or only in this fiscal year, in which case it wouldn't add.
Mark, I asked this. I asked this of the budget office commissioner, and what I was told is we have booked $10 million towards the $20 million. That's baked into our forecast. That is already, the council's already made that decision. So the numbers we're getting of discretionary money in this budget are net of $10 million that's going to housing. That means we have a $10 million delta that we have to fill.
Okay, I don't know where you're getting that 10 from, because we put 5 in the bump, 1.2 from the so-called Airbnb money. Where's the other?
No, they're different. They put 10 into the forecast.
They put 10 into the forecast.
And we have to debate as a council whether any of those other, the council has to decide whether any other revenue decisions we've made count towards the balance of the 10 that we owe.
Okay.
That has not been decided.
So it might be a relatively small amount.
Well, you might argue, and I might agree, that the Airbnb money counts towards the 10.
Well, it's new money. Hmm? It's new money for housing.
It's new money. If you said a dollar of TIF over here counts, I might push back, because I'm not sure that's new. That's the new
money.
It's
not ongoing either.
Yeah.
So this is really good news, and it's important that it's manageable. We have a number, and it's going to be really challenging to get to that number this year. And still, $20 million with $10 million already budgeted for is something that is not unfeasible that we might be able to get there. And I think that's really good news. And still, and that will take additional maybe cuts or revenue from the community, but that's the number that we need to get there.
Commissioner, I can't believe that I'm saying this to you, but isn't feasible with our current revenue forecast without making cuts to existing other services such as police, fire, and parks.
Right. But it's not $40 million ongoing. It's a number that may not be able to be achieved this year, in fact, without devastating cuts to police, fire, and parks. But it's not a number that we need another $30 million of ongoing money.
And the only other caution I would make is that it doesn't represent the total amount of capital that will be needed to generate to meet the unit need over time. I mean, that there's the $10 million will allow hopefully the buy down of affordability for a number of units, but I think closing that gap is going to require additional investment over time. Exactly how much I can't say.
What you've baked in here is $30 million between us and the county, $20 million for their services, and $10 million ongoing for construction. That's good.
Yeah. Okay, so thank you, Ryan. So I'm going to move us quickly because we have folks here. So this was to give you a sense, the additional resources the chair mentioned that you put about $2.5 million of additional service money in, the county put about $2.5 million of additional service money, just so you can see where that's going. It's meeting that year one number of additional placements that Ryan mentioned. We expanded the family shelter to year round. It's enough resource to place another 248 families. In part, we've got a commitment of 200 Section 8 vouchers from Home Forward. That's part of our ability to do that, which is fantastic. We'll move an additional 100 youth into permanent housing, as well as pregnant and parenting youth. And then there's an expansion of services to people with disabilities, income acquisition on the disability benefits side, the intensive street engagement team that you funded that will house some very disabled folks. And then for women, we year-rounded the women's shelter beds, and there's enough resource there to also expand the number of placements of women that we're able to do. A big chunk of the new resource went into the Veterans Initiative, 180 additional housing placements in this year. With those resources, as you know, we were able to house 695 veterans in the calendar year 2015 and reach our goal, actually exceed our goal. It also is funding additional shelter capacity. And then because this is a partnership with Gresham, there is a resource allocation to Gresham in East County for some specific work that they're doing. So that's 15-16, and I'm sorry I'm moving quickly, but now I want to come to the 2016-17 goals, and this is just what Ryan showed on the graph. In order to stay on target with our objective of meeting half the unmet need, we need to expand the number of placements by 1,350 individuals over what we were doing 2 years ago, so get to 4,350 placements. We need to start investing in additional prevention. That's that blue line. 1,000 additional preventions is what we're targeting. That will still leave a significant unmet need for safety off the streets, that light blue triangle that was on Ryan's graph. We think it's at least 650 additional safety off the streets beds options for people. So those have been the numeric targets, the goals that have driven the budgeting work that our work groups have been doing, that the coordinating board did. The executive committee gave us additional guidance to prioritize women, to eliminate the overrepresentation of people of color in the homeless population, and to serve people with severe mental illness. In order to get to those targets, we've been talking about the $30 million. This next graph is the pie chart of that. There is $10 million to go towards development, as we've said. We've been working with a budget allocation of $2.5 million to prevention, those 1,000 preventions, $5 million to fund the startup costs and operations for those 650 additional shelter beds, and then $12.5 million to accomplish the additional 1,350 permanent housing placements and retentions that are needed to stay on track. All right, so just to set the stage, with those numbers and that direction from the executive committee, we asked our work groups to convene. Again, we have a housing work group, a healthcare work group, an employment work group, and a safety off the streets work group. They met a couple of months ago and began looking at the original action plans that they had developed, the strategies, and said, okay, if we have this much resource to work with, what are our priority strategies? What do we recommend to the coordinating board and then to the executive committee be the investments that we make? So I want to invite up, actually, I realize I think Stacy is not. She wasn't sure she was going to be able to. So I will walk through the housing strategies briefly with you.